chair in the living room. Kronsky claimed it for himself. He drank half the pint in two ginormous swallows, his Adam's apple rolling like a bobber at the end of a hooked line, paying no attention to Terry or Frank. A muted television sat on a stand, showing footage of several cocooned women floating on the surface of the Atlantic Ocean. They looked like weird life rafts. What if a shark decided to bite one? Terry wondered. He guessed that if that happened, the shark might be in for a surprise. What did any of it mean? What was the point? Terry decided the point might be gin. He got out Frank's flask and had a tug.
"Those women are from the big plane that crashed," Johnny Lee said. "Interesting that they float like that, isn't it? The stuff must be mighty light. Like Kapok or something."
"Look at them all," Terry marveled.
"Yes, yes, quite a sight."
Johnny Lee smacked his lips. He was a licensed private investigator, but not the kind that checked up on cheating spouses or solved mysteries. Until 2014, he had worked for Ulysses Energy Solutions, the coal company, cycling through their various operations, posing as a miner and listening for rumors of union organizing, working to undercut leaders who seemed particularly effective. A company dog, in other words. Then had come trouble. A right smart of trouble, one could say. There was a cave-in. Kronsky had been the man handling the explosives. The three miners who had been buried under the rock had been talking loudly about holding a vote. Almost as damning, one had been wearing a t-shirt with the face of Woody Guthrie on it. Lawyers hired by Ulysses had prevented the levying of charges, a tragic accident they successfully argued before the grand jury, but Kronsky had been forced into retirement. That was why Johnny Lee had come home to Dueling, where he had been born. Now, in his ideally located apartment, right around the corner from the liquor store, he was in the process of drinking himself to death. Each month, a check from UES arrived via Federal Express. A woman Terry knew at the bank told him that the notation on the stub was always the same. Fees. Whatever his fees amounted to wasn't a fortune, as the crummy apartment proved, but Kronsky managed on it. The whole story was familiar to Terry because hardly a month passed that the police weren't called out to the man's apartment by a neighbor who had heard breaking glass, a rock or a brick thrown through one of Kronsky's windows, undoubtedly by union spooks. Johnny Lee never called himself. He had let it be known that he was not overly concerned. J.L. Kronsky didn't give shit one about the union. One afternoon, not long before the Aurora outbreak, when Terry had been partnered with Lila in Unit 1, the conversation had turned to Kronsky. She said, "Eventually, some disaffected miner, probably a relative of one of the guys Kronsky got killed, is going to blow his head off, and the miserable son of a bitch will probably be glad to go." 8. "There's a situation at the prison," Terry said.
"There's a situation everywhere, Mr. Man."
Kronsky had a beaten face, pouched and haggard and dark eyes.
"Forget everywhere," Frank said. "We're here."
"I don't give a tin shit where you are,"
Johnny Lee said and polished off the pint.
"We might need to blow something up," Terry said.
Barry Holden and his station-robbing friends had taken a lot of firepower, but had missed the Griner brothers' bump of C4. "You know how to work with plastic, don't you?"
"Could be I do," Kronsky said. "What's in it for me, Mr. Man?"
Terry calculated.
"I tell you what, Pudge Marone from the Squeak is with us, and I think he'll let you run an endless tab for the rest of your life,"
which Terry guessed wouldn't be long.
"Hmm," Johnny Lee said.
"And, of course, it's also a chance to do your town a great service."
"Dueling can go fuck itself," Johnny Lee Kronsky said.
"But still, why not?
Just why the fuck not?"
That gave them 20. 9. Dueling Correctional did not have guard towers. It had a flat tar paper roof, piped with vents, ducts, and exhaust stems.
There wasn't much in the way of cover beyond a half foot of brick edging. After assessing this roof, Willie Burke told Clint he liked the 360-degree perspective of the entire perimeter, but he liked his balls even more.
"Nothing up here that could stop a bullet, see? How about that shed there?"
the old man pointed down below. Although labeled equipment shed on the prison blueprints, it was your basic catch-all, containing the riding lawnmower that inmates, trustworthy ones, used to groom the softball field, plus gardening tools, sports equipment, and stacks of moldering newspapers and magazines bound with twine. Most importantly, it was built of cement blocks. They had a closer look. Clint dragged a chair out behind the shed, and Willie had a seat there beneath the overhang of the shed's roof. From this position, a man would be sheltered from the view of anyone at the fence, but would still be visible at either end of a firing line that stretched between the shed and the prison.
"If they're just on one side, I should be all right," said Willie. "I'll see him from the corner of my eye and take cover."
"Both sides at the same time?" Clint asked.
"If they do that, I'll be for it."
"You need help. Backup."
"When you say that, Doc, it makes me wish I'd done more churching in the days of my youth."
The old fellow regarded him amiably. Upon arriving at the prison, the only explanation that he had required of Clint was a further assurance that the stand they were making was what Lila would have wanted. Clint had readily given it to Willie, although at this stage he was no longer sure what Lila would have wanted. It seemed like Lila had been gone for years. Clint tried to reflect the same amiability, a bit of lighthearted savoir-faire in the face of the enemy, but what remained of his sense of humor seemed to have fallen out of the back of Barry Holden's RV, along with Gerda Holden and Garth Flickinger.
"You were in Vietnam, weren't you, Willie?"
Willie held up his left hand. The meat of his palm was gouged with scar tissue.
"As it happens, a few bits of me are still there."
"How did it feel," Clint asked, "when you were there? You must have lost friends."
"Oh, yes," Willie said. "I lost friends. As to how I felt, mostly just scared, confused, all the time. Is that how you feel right now?"
"It is," Clint admitted. "I never trained for this." They stood there in the milky afternoon light.
Clint wondered if Willie sensed what Clint was really feeling. Some fear and confusion, that was true, but also excitement. A certain euphoria infused the preparations. The prospect of pouring the frustration and dismay and loss and impossibility of everything into action. Clint could observe it happening to himself, a rush of aggressive adrenaline that was as old as apes. He told himself he shouldn't be thinking that way, and maybe not, but it felt good. It was as if some guy who looked exactly like him, driving a coupe with the top down, had pulled up beside the old Clint at a stoplight, nodded once in recognition. Then, at the flip of the green, his doppelganger had planted the accelerator and the old Clint was watching him roar off. The new Clint had to hurry, because he was on a mission, and being on a mission was good. While they were making their way to the rear of the prison, Willie told him about the moths and the fairy footprints he'd seen near Truman Mayweather's trailer. Millions of moths, it seemed, coating the branches of trees, rolling above the canopy of the woods in swarms.
"Was it from her?"
Like everyone else, Willie had heard the rumors.
"That woman you got?"
"Yes," Clint said. "And that's not even the half of it."
Willie said he didn't doubt it. They dragged out a second chair and issued an auto to Billy Wettermore. It had been converted, legally or not, Clint didn't know, nor did he care, to full auto. That put a man on each end of the shed. It wasn't perfect, just the best they could do.
10. Behind the front desk at the sheriff's office, the body of Linnie Mars lay cocooned on the floor with her laptop beside her and still broadcasting that vine of the falling London Eye. It appeared to Terry that she had slid out of her chair when she finally drifted off to sleep. She was in a heap, partly blocking the hallway that led to the official areas of the facility.
Kronsky stepped over her and walked down the hallway in search of the evidence locker. Terry didn't like that. He called after him.
Hey, you noticed the fucking person here on the floor?
It's okay, Terry, Frank said. We'll take care of her. They carried Linny to a holding cell and lowered her gently to the mattress. She hadn't been out for long. The webs were thin across her eyes and mouth. Her lips were twisted up in an expression of delirious happiness. Who knew why? Maybe just because her struggle to stay awake was over. Terry had another drink. He lowered the flask, and the wall of the cell rushed at him, and he stuck out his hand to stop it. After a moment, he was able to push up straight again.
I'm worried about you, Frank said. You're over-medicating.
I'm perfecto. Terry waved his hand at a moth that was bothering his ear.
Are you happy we're arming up, Frank? It's what you wanted, isn't it?
Frank gave Terry a long look. It was totally unthreatening, totally blank. He stared at Terry the way that kids looked at television screens, as if they were gone from their bodies.
No, Frank said. I wouldn't say I'm too happy. It's the job, that's all. The one in front of us.
Do you always tell yourself that before you kick somebody's ass? Terry asked, genuinely interested, and was surprised when Frank recoiled, as if from a slap. Kronsky was in the waiting room when they came out. He'd found the plastic explosive, also a bundle of dynamite someone had found in a gravel pit near the Griner property and turned in for disposal. Johnny Lee looked disapproving.
This dino had no business back there, folksies. It gets old and cranky. The C4 now.
He shook it, making Frank wince.
You could run it over with a truck and nothing would happen.
So you want to leave the dynamite? Terry asked.
Jesus, no. Kronsky looked offended. I love me some dino. Always have. Dino's what you call old school. Need to wrap it in a blanket is all. Or maybe Sleeping Beauty there's got a nice thick sweater in the closet. Oh, and I'll need to get some items from the hardware store. I trust the police department has an open account.
Before Terry and Frank left, they packed a duffel bag with the handguns and ammo that hadn't been looted, and carried out all the vests and helmets they could rustle up. There wasn't much, but their posse, really no sense calling it anything else, would bring plenty of armament from home. Linny hadn't left a sweater in the closet, so Johnny Lee had wrapped the dynamite in a couple of towels from the bathroom. He held it to his chest as if carrying an infant.
Getting late in the day for any kind of assault, Frank observed, if that's what it comes to.
Terry said, I know. We'll get the boys out there tonight, make sure everyone knows what's what and who's in charge. He looked pointedly at Frank as he said this. Requisition a couple school buses from the town motor pool and parked them at the intersection of Route 31 and West Lavin, where the roadblock was, so the fellas don't have to sleep raw. Keep 6 or 8 of them on watch in a, you know. He made a circle in the air. Frank helped him out. A perimeter.
Yeah, that. If we have to go in, we'll do it tomorrow morning from the east. We'll need a couple of bulldozers to bust through. Send Pearl and Treater to pick out a couple from the public works yard. Keys are in the office trailer there.
Good, Frank said, because it was. He wouldn't have thought of bulldozers.
First thing tomorrow morning, we bulldoze the fences and come at the main building across the parking lot. That way the sun will be in their eyes. Step 1, push them deep, away from the doors and windows. Step 2, Johnny Lee blows the front doors and we're inside. Press them to throw down their weapons. At that point, I think they will. Send a few around the far side to make sure they can't bolt for it.
Makes sense, Frank said.
But first...
First?
We talk to Norcross. Tonight. Face to face, if he's man enough. Offer him a chance to give the woman up before something happens that can't be taken back.
Frank's eyes expressed what he felt.
I know what you're thinking, Frank, but if he's a reasonable man, he'll see it's the right thing. He is responsible for more lives than just hers, after all.
And if he still says no?
Terry shrugged.
Then we go in and take her.
No matter what?
That's right, no matter what.
They went out,
and Terry locked the glass double doors of the police station behind him. 11. Rand Quigley got his toolbox and spent 2 hours chiseling and hammering out the small wire-reinforced window that was embedded in the concrete wall of the visitor's room. Tig Murphy sat nearby, drinking Coke and smoking a cigarette. The no-smoking reg had been lifted.
"If you were an inmate," he said, "that'd get about 5 years added to your sentence."
"Good thing I'm not an inmate then, isn't it?" Tig tapped ash on the floor and decided not to say what he was thinking. If being locked in meant you were an inmate, that's what they were now.
"Man, they really built this place, didn't they?"
"Uh-huh, like it was a prison or something," Rand said.
"Yuck, yuck, yuck."
When the glass finally fell out, Tig clapped. "Thank you, ladies and gentlemen," Rand said, doing Elvis. "Thank you very much." With the window removed, Rand could stand on top of the table they had pulled below as a shooting platform and stick his weapon through. This was his spot, with clean angles on the parking lot and the front gate.
"They think we are pussies," Rand said,
"but we are not."
"Got that right, Rando."
Clint poked his head in. "Tig, with me." The two of them walked up the stairs to the raised level of B-Wing. This was the prison's highest point, the only second floor in the structure. There were windows in the cells that faced out on West Lavin. These were stronger even than the window in the visitor's room, thick, reinforced, and sandwiched between layers of concrete. It was hard to imagine Rand knocking one out of the wall with just hand tools.
"We can't defend this end," Tig said.
"No," Clint said, "but it makes a hell of a lookout post, and we don't need to defend it, right? There's no way through here." That seemed inarguable to Clint, and to Scott Hughes, too, who was relaxing a few cells down the line and listening in.
"I'm sure you guys are going to get yourselves killed one way or another, and I won't be crying any tears when it happens," he called. "But Shrink Boy's right. It'd take a bazooka to blow a hole in this wall."
12. On the day two opposing groups of dueling men armed up, preparing to make war, less than 100 women were still awake in the Tri-Counties. One was Eve Black, one was Angel Fitzroy, one was Jeanette Sorley. Vanessa Lampley was a fourth. Earlier that day, her husband finally nodded off in his armchair, allowing Van to do what she had decided to do. Since she had returned home from the prison after shooting and killing Reed Dempster, Tommy Lampley had tried to stay awake with her as long as he could. Van had been glad for the company. A cooking competition show had done him in, though, lulling him to dreamland with a tutorial on molecular gastronomy. Van waited to make sure he was soundly out before she left. She wasn't about to assign her husband, 10 years her senior, with titanium hips and afflicted by angina, the thankless task of somehow taking care of her body for however many years remained to him. Nor did Van have any interest in becoming the world's most dismal piece of furniture. Tired as she was still light on her feet, and crept from the room without disturbing his thin sleep. In the garage, she got her hunting rifle and loaded it. She yanked up the door, fired up the ATV, and rolled out. Her plan was simple. Cut through the woods to the ridge above the road, breathe in the fresh air, take in the view, jot a note to her husband, and put the barrel under her chin. Good night. At least there were no kids to worry about. She went slow because she was afraid, weary as she was, of crashing. The ATV's heavy tires sent every root and rock jolting up her thick arms and deep into her bones. Van didn't mind. The thin rain was all right, too. Despite the exhaustion, her thoughts crawled. She was intensely aware of every physical sensation. Would it have been better to die without knowing you were going to, like Ree? Van could ask the question, but her brain could not break it down in a way that allowed a satisfactory answer. Any response dissolved before it could form. Why did it feel so bad that she had shot an inmate who would have killed another inmate if she hadn't? Why did it feel so bad just to have done her job? Those answers wouldn't coalesce either, couldn't even begin to. Van arrived at the top of the ridge. She shut off the ATV and dismounted. Far away, in the direction of the prison, a haze of black hovered over the dying day, damp residue from the forest fire that had burned itself out. Directly below, the land descended in a long, easy grade. At the base of the grade was a muddy stream, fattening in the rain. Above the stream, a few hundred feet away, was a hunting cabin with a mossy roof. Smoke scribbles pumped from the stovepipe chimney. She patted her pockets and realized that she had completely forgotten paper and something to write with. Van wanted to laugh. Suicide really wasn't that complex, was it? But a sigh was the best she could manage. There was no help for it, and her reasoning ought not to be that hard to figure out. If she were found at all, that was, and if anyone cared. Van unstrapped the rifle from her back. The door of the cabin banged open just as she located the barrel against the shelf of her chin.
"He just better still have that fucking boom tube,"
said a man, his voice carrying crisp and clear.
"Or he'll wish that dog catcher had finished the job on him. Oh, and bring along the scanner. I want to keep up on what the cops are doing."
Van lowered her rifle and watched as two men climbed into a shiny Silverado truck and drove away. She was sure she knew them, and looking like they did, a couple of road-hard and put-away-wet woods rats, it wasn't from any Chamber of Commerce awards ceremony. Their names would have come to her immediately if she hadn't been so sleep-deprived. Her mind felt full of mud. She could still feel the jouncing ATV, even though it was no longer moving. Phantom dots of light went zooming across her vision. When the truck was gone, she decided to visit the cabin. There would be something to write on inside, if only the back of a calendar, years out of date. "And I'll need something to pin it to my shirt," she said. Her voice sounded foggy and foreign, the voice of someone else. And there was someone else, standing just beside her. Only when she turned her head, the someone was gone. That was happening more and more, watchers lurking at the farthest reach of her vision, hallucinations. How long could you stay awake before all rational thought broke down and you lost your mind completely? Van remounted her ATV and drove it along the ridge until the land descended and she could switch back along the rutted track that led to the cabin. The cabin smelled of beans, beer, fried deer meat, and man farts. Dishes cluttered the table, the sink was filled with more, and there were clotted pots on the wood-burning stove. On the mantel was a picture of a fiercely grinning man with a pick over his shoulder, and a countryman's battered fedora pulled so low on his head that the brim bent the tops of his ears. Looking at the sepia-toned photo, Vanessa realized exactly who it was she had seen, because her father had pointed out the man in that picture to her when she had been no more than 12. He had been going into the squeaky wheel. "That is Big Lowell Griner," Daddy had said, "and I want you to keep clear of him, honey. If he should ever say hello to you, say hello back, ain't it a nice day, and keep walking." So that's who those two were, Big Lowell's no-account boys, Maynard and Little Low Griner, big as life and driving a new pickup, when they were supposed to be jugged over in Coughlin, awaiting trial for, among other things, a murder Kitty McDavid had witnessed and agreed to testify about. On a pine-paneled wall of the short corridor that probably led to the cabin's bedrooms, Van saw a battered notebook hanging from a piece of string. A sheet from that would do just fine for a suicide note, but she suddenly decided she wanted to stay awake and alive at least a little longer. She left, glad to escape the stink, and drove her ATV away from the cabin as fast as she dared. After a mile or so, the track emptied into one of Dueling County's many dirt roads. Dust hung on the left, not much on account of the drizzle, but enough to tell her which way the fugitives had turned. They had a good lead on her by the time she reached Route 7, but the land here was downsloping and open, which made it easy to see the truck, diminished by distance but clearly headed for town. Van slapped herself briskly across each cheek and followed. She was wet through now, but the cold would help her stay awake a little while longer. If she were on the lam from a murder charge, she'd be halfway to Georgia by now. Not these two. They were headed back to town, no doubt to do something nasty, as was their wont. She wanted to know what it was, and maybe stop it. Atonement for what she'd had to do to Ree was not out of the question. Chapter 11 1 Fritz Meeschaum didn't want to give up his bazooka, at least not without payment. When May seized him firmly by the shoulders and Lowe twisted his right arm nearly up to his shoulder blades, however, he changed his mind and lifted a trapdoor in the floor of his ramshackle cabin, revealing the treasure for which the Griner brothers had come. Little Lowe had expected it to be green, like the ones in World War II movies, but Fritz's bazooka was painted a dusty black, with a long serial number running up the side and some of those funny Russian letters beneath. A scale of rust rimmed the mouth. Lying beside it was a duffel bag containing a dozen shells stenciled with more words in Russian. There were also 8 or 10 rifles and as many as 20 handguns, most semi-auto. The brothers stuffed a couple in their belts. There was nothing like pistols in a man's belt to make him feel like he had the right of way.
"What's that thing?"
asked May, pointing to a shiny black square of plastic above the bazooka's trigger housing.
"Dunno," Fritz said, peering at it. "Some kind of inventory control for the bean counters, most likely."
"It's got words in English on it," May said.
Fritz shrugged.
"So what? I got a John Deere cap with Chinese shit on the tag inside. Everybody sells everything to anyone. Thanks to the Jews, that's just the way the world works. The Jews, they—" "Never you mind the damn Jews," Little Lowe said.
If he let Fritz get on a roll about the Jews, he'd shortly be on to the federal government, and they'd be hunkered around this fucking hole in the floor for the rest of the spring.
"All I care about is, does it work? If it don't, tell me now, lest we come back here and tear off your ballsack."
"I think we should tear off his ballsack anyhow, Lowe,"
May said.
"That's what I think. I bet it's small."
"It works, it works,"
Fritz said, presumably talking about the bazooka rather than his ballsack.
"Now let loose of me, you scum."
"Got a mouth on him, don't he, brother?"
Maynard observed.
"Yes," Little Lowe said. "Yes, he does, but we'll forgive him this time. Get a couple of those grease guns."
"Those ain't grease guns," Fritz said indignantly. "Those are fully automatic, army—"
"It'd suit me fine if you shut up," Lowe said. "And what suits me is gonna suit you. We're going now, but if this bazooka of yours don't work, we will return and make it disappear up your saggy ass all the way to the trigger housing."
"Yes, sir, what he said,"
May exclaimed.
"Try shitting after taking a load like that."
"What are you going to do with my boom tube?"
Little Lowe Griner smiled gently.
"Hush now," he said, "and don't worry about what don't concern you."
2. From a hilltop a quarter of a mile away, Van Lampley observed the Silverado pull into Fritz Meeschaum's scabrous dooryard. She observed the Griners get out and return to their stolen truck a few minutes later, carrying stuff, no doubt more stolen goods, which they put in the truck bed. Then they took off again, once more in the direction of dueling. She considered pulling into Meeschaum's place once they left, but in her current state, she felt incapable of asking any questions that would make sense. And really, did she have to? Everyone in dueling knew that Fritz Meeschaum was in love with anything that had a trigger and went bang. The Griner brothers had stopped to gun up. It was as plain as the nose on her face. Well, she had a gun herself, her good old .30-06. Probably not much of a shake compared to what was now in the bed of that stolen truck, but so what? Did she really have anything to lose that she hadn't been planning just an hour ago to give away to the universe? "Wanna mess with me, boys?" Van said, keying the ATV and revving it. A mistake, as she had never bothered to check how much gas was in the Suzuki's tank before setting out. Well, why don't we see just who messes with who? 3. The Griners had listened to their scanner only off and on during their days at the cabin, but they did so constantly on the trip to town, because the police band had gone crazy. The transmissions and crosstalk meant little to Maynard, whose brains rarely got out of first gear, but Lowell picked up the general drift. Someone, a bunch of someones actually, had taken a mess of guns from the armory at the sheriff's station, and the cops were just as mad as hornets in a shook-up nest. At least two of the gun robbers had been killed, a cop had also been killed, and the rest of the gang had gotten away in a big RV. They had taken the stolen guns up to the women's prison. The cops also kept talking about some woman they wanted to pull out of the Ho Hotel, and it seemed like the gun robbers wanted to keep her for themselves. Lowe couldn't follow that part. He didn't much care, either. What he cared about was the cops had raised up a posse and were preparing for a big fight, maybe starting tomorrow morning. And they planned to rendezvous at the intersection of Route 31 and West Lavin Road. That meant the sheriff's department would be undefended. It also gave Lowell a brilliant idea about how they might be able to nail Kitty McDavid.
Low? Yes, brother. I can't make out from all that bibble-babble who's in charge. Some say Deputy Coombs took over from the Norcross bitch, and some say a fella named Frank.
Who's Frank?
Don't know and don't care, Little O said. But when we get into town, you keep an eye peeled for a kid by himself.
Which kid, brother?
One old enough to ride a bike and carry a tail, said Lo,
just as the stolen Silverado passed the sign reading, Welcome to Dueling, a nice place to raise your family. 4. The Suzuki ATV could do 60 on the open road, but with night coming down and her reflexes shot to perdition, Van dared no more than 40. By the time she passed the Welcome to Dueling sign, the Silverado containing the Griner brothers had disappeared. Maybe she'd lost them, but maybe not. Main Street was nearly deserted, and she hoped to spot it there, either parked or cruising slowly while those bad boys looked for something worth holding up. If she didn't spot it, she supposed the best she could do was pop into the sheriff's office and report them to whoever was on duty. That would be sort of an anticlimax for a woman who was hoping to do something good to make up for a shooting she still felt bad about, but it was like her daddy always said, Sometimes you get what you want, but mostly you get what you get. The beginning of downtown proper was marked by Barb's Beauty Salon and Hot Nails on one side of the road, and Ace Hardware, recently visited by Johnny Lee Kronsky in search of tools, wires, and batteries, on the other. It was between these two fine business establishments that Vanessa's ATV chugged twice, backfired, and died. She checked the gauge and saw the needle resting on E. Wasn't that just the perfect end to a perfect fucking day? There was a Zony's one block up where she could buy a few gallons of gas, assuming anyone was bothering to run the place. But it was getting dark, those damn Griners could be anywhere, and even walking a block seemed like quite a trek in her current state. It might be better to go ahead and end it, as she'd set out to do earlier. Except she hadn't become a statewide arm wrestling champion by giving up when the going got tough, had she? And wasn't that what she was thinking of? Giving up? Not until my damn hand's down on the damn table, Van told her beached ATV, and began plodding up the deserted sidewalk toward the sheriff's station. 5. The business directly across from the cop shop was the Drew T. Berry Indemnity Company, proprietor currently out at West Lavin Road with the rest of the posse. Lowe parked the Silverado behind it in a space marked, Reserved for Berry Employee, All Others Will Be Towed. The back door was locked, but two slams of May's beefy shoulder fixed that. Lowe followed him inside, dragging the kid they had found riding his bike down by the bowling alley. The kid in question happened to be Kent Daly, member of the high school tennis team and close friend of Eric Blass. Kent's bike was now in the back of the Silverado. He was sniveling, although he was really too old for such behavior. It was Lowe's opinion that sniveling was okay for teenage girls, but boys should start to taper off at 10 and be done with it by 12 or so. He was willing to give this one a pass, however. After all, he probably thought he was going to be raped and murdered.
You need to shut up, youngster, he said. You'll be all right if you behave.
He frog-marched Kent into the big front room, which was filled with desks and posters telling how the right insurance policy could save your family from a life of poverty. On the front window, which faced the deserted business district, Drew T. Barry's name was printed backward in tall gold flake letters. As Lo looked out, he saw a woman come slowly up the sidewalk on the other side. Not much of a looker, heavyset, lesbo haircut, but seeing any woman today was a rarity. She glanced at the Barry establishment, but with no lights inside, could see nothing but the reflection of the streetlights, which had just flicked on. She climbed the steps to the cop shop and tried the door. Locked. And wasn't that small-town police for you, Lo thought. Lock the front door after the guns are stolen. Now she was trying the intercom.
Mister, Kent whined, I want to go home. You can have my bike if you want it.
We can have anything we want, you pimply little peckerwood,
May said. Lo twisted the boy's wrist, making him holler.
What part of shut up don't you understand? Brother, go get Mr. Bazooki and the shells.
May left. Lo turned to the kid.
Card in your wallet says your name is Kent Daly, and you live at 15 Juniper Street. That right?
Yes, sir,
the boy said, wiping snot from his nose up one cheek with the heel of his hand.
Kent Daly, and I don't want any trouble. I want to go home.
You're in a real pickle, Kent. My brother is an awful sick man. There is nothing he loves more than to wreck a human being. What'd you do cause you to be so unlucky, do you suppose?
Kent licked his lips and blinked rapidly. He opened his mouth and shut it.
You did something all right.
Lo laughed. Guilt was hilarious.
Who's at home?
My dad and my mom. Only my mom's, you know.
Kitchen 40 winks, is she? Or 440?
Yes, sir.
But your dad's fine?
Yes, sir.
Would you like me to go to 15 Juniper Street and blow your dad's fucking head off?
No, sir,
Kent whispered. Tears rolled down his pale cheeks.
No, of course you wouldn't. But I will, unless you do just as I say. Will you do as I say?
Yes, sir.
Not even a whisper now, just a breeze through the boy's lips.
How old are you, Kent?
17.
Jesus, almost old enough to vote and grizzling like a baby. Quit on it.
Kent did his best.
Ride that bike pretty fast, can you?
I guess so. I won the Tri-County 40K last year.
Little Lo didn't know a 40K from a serving tray and didn't care.
You know where Route 31 meets up with West Lavin Road, the road that goes to the prison?
Maynard had returned with the bazooka and the case of shells. Across the street, the heavyset woman had given up on the intercom and was heading back the way she had come with her head hanging down. The drizzle had ceased at last. Lo gave Kent, who was staring at the bazooka with dreadful fascination, a shake.
Know that road, do you?
Yes, sir.
Good. There are a bunch of men up there, and I'm going to give you a message. You will give it to the one named Terry, or the one named Frank, or both of them. Now listen.
6. Terry and Frank were, at that moment, getting out of Unit 1 and approaching the double gates of Dueling Correctional, where Clint and another guy stood waiting for them. 10 members of the posse were back at the intersection. The rest had taken up positions around the prison at what Terry called the Compass Rose. North, northeast, east, southeast, south, southwest, west, and northwest. There were woods, and they were damp, but none of the guys seemed to mind. They were high on excitement. And they'll stay that way until the first one takes a bullet and starts screaming, Terry thought. Someone's tricked-out truck was blocking the inner gate. The dead space had been filled with tires, and soaked in gasoline from the smell. Not a bad move. Terry could almost admire it. He shone his light on Norcross, then on the bearded man standing next to him.
"Willie Burke," said Terry. "I'm sorry to see you here."
"And I'm sorry to see you here," Willie responded. "Doing what you shouldn't be doing. Overstepping your authority. Playing the vigilante man."
He took his pipe from the pocket of his bibbles and started to load it. Terry had never been sure if Norcross was a doctor or just a mister, so he settled on his given name.
"Clint, this has almost gone beyond talking. One of my deputies has been killed. Vern Wrangle. I think you knew him."
Clint sighed and shook his head. "I did, and I'm sorry. He was a fine man. I hope you feel equally sorry about Garth Flickinger and Gerda Holden." "The Holden girl's death was an act of self-defense," Frank said. "She was ripping Deputy Wrangle's goddamn throat out."
"I want to talk to Barry Holden," Clint said.
"He's dead," Frank said, "and it's your fault." Terry turned to Frank.
"You need to let me handle this."
Frank raised his hands and stepped back. He knew Coombs was right. There was his damn temper getting the best of him again, but he hated him for it just the same. What he felt like doing was climbing that fence, barbed wire rolls at the top be damned, and knocking the heads of those two smug sons of bitches together. Evie Black's goading voice was still in his head.
"Clint, listen to me," Terry said. "I'm willing to say there's blame on both sides, and I'm willing to guarantee that no charges will be brought against any of you here if you let me take the woman into custody now."
"Is Barry really dead?" Clint asked.
"Yes," the acting chief of police said. "He attacked Vern, too."
Willie Burke reached over and gripped Clint's shoulder.
"Let's talk about Evie," Clint said. "What exactly do you plan to do with her? What can you do?"
Terry appeared stumped, but Frank was ready, speaking with assurance. "We're going to take her to the sheriff's station. While Terry's questioning her, I'm going to get a team of doctors from the state hospital down here double quick. Between the cops and the docs, we're going to find out what she is, what she did to the women, and whether or not she can fix it."
"She says she did nothing," Clint said, staring off into the distance. "She says she's just an emissary."
Frank turned to Terry.
"You know what? I think this man is totally full of shit."
Terry gave him a reproachful, if slightly red-eyed, look. Frank once again raised his hands and stepped back.
"You don't have a single medical doctor in there," Terry said. "And you don't have any PAs you can call, because I seem to remember that they're both women and they'll be in cocoons by now. So bottom line, you're not examining her, you're just holding her."
"Holding on to her," Frank growled.
"And listening to what she tells you."
"Swallowing it, you mean," Frank shouted.
"Be quiet, Frank."
Terry spoke mildly, but when he turned back to Clint and Willie, his cheeks were flushed. "But he's right. You're swallowing it. Drinking the Kool-Aid, so to speak."
"You don't understand," Clint said. He sounded weary. "She's not a woman at all, at least not in the sense we understand. I don't think she's entirely human. She has certain abilities. She can call rats. That much I'm sure of. They do what she wants. It's how she got Hicks's cell phone. All those moths people have been seeing around town have something to do with her, too. And she knows things. Things she can't know."
"You saying she's a witch?" Terry asked. He pulled out the flask and had a sip. Probably not the best way to negotiate, but he needed something, and right now.
"Come on, Clint. Next you'll be telling me she can walk on water."
Frank thought of the fire spinning in the air in his living room, and then exploding into moths, and of the phone call, Evie Black saying that she had seen him protect Nana. He tightened his arms across his chest, squeezing down his anger. What did it matter what Eve Black was? What mattered was what had happened, was happening, and how to fix it.
"Open your eyes, son," Willie said. "Look at what's happened to the world over the last week. All the women asleep in cocoons,
And you're sticking at the idea the black woman may be something supernatural? You boys need to do better. Need to quit on sticking your fingers where they don't belong and let this thing play out like the doc says she wants.
Because Terry could think of no adequate reply, he took another drink. He saw the way Clint was looking at him and had a third, just to spite the bastard. Who was he to judge, hiding behind prison walls while Terry tried to hold the rest of the world together?
What she's asked for is a few more days, Clint said, and that's what I want you to give her.
He nailed Terry's eyes with his own. She's expecting bloodshed. She's made that much clear. Because she believes that's the only way men know how to solve their problems. Let's not give her what she expects. Stand down. Give it 72 hours. Then we can revisit the situation.
Really? And what do you think will change?
The liquor hadn't taken over Terry's mind yet. So far it was only visiting. And he thought, almost prayed,
give me an answer I can believe in.
But Clint only shook his head.
I don't know. She says it's not entirely in her hands. But 72 hours without shooting would be the right first step. Of that, I'm sure. Oh, and she says that the women have to take a vote.
Terry nearly laughed. How the fuck are sleeping women gonna do that?
I don't know, Clint said.
He's playing for time, Frank thought. Spouting any old made-up thing that comes into his shrinky-dink brain. Surely you're still sober enough to see that, aren't you, Terry?
I need to think it over, Terry said.
All right, but you need to think clearly, so do yourself a favor and pour the rest of that liquor out on the ground. His eyes shifted to Frank, and they were the cold ones of the orphan boy who had fought for milkshakes.
Frank here thinks he's the solution, but I think he's the problem. I think she knew there'd be a guy like him. I think she knows there always is.
Frank leaped forward, reached through the fence, seized Norcross by the throat, and choked him until his eyeballs first bulged, then dropped out to dangle on his cheeks. But only in his mind. He waited. Terry considered, then spat in the dirt.
Fuck you, Clint. You're no real doctor.
And when he raised the flask and took another long, defiant swallow, Frank raised an inward cheer. By tomorrow, Acting Sheriff Coombs would be in the bag. Then he, Frank, would take over. There would be no 72 hours, and he didn't care if Eve Black was a witch, a fairy princess, or the Red Queen of Wonderland. Everything he needed to know about Eve Black had been in that one short phone call. Stop this, he had told her, almost begged her when she called him on her stolen cell. Let the women go.
You'll have to kill me first, the woman had replied.
Which was what Frank intended to do. If it brought the women back, happy ending. If not, revenge for taking away the only person in his life who mattered. Either way, problem solved. 7. Just as Van Lampley reached her stalled ATV, with no idea what to do next, a kid tore past on one of those bikes with the ape hanger handlebars. He was making enough speed to blow his hair back from his forehead, and he wore an expression of stark, bug-eyed terror. It could have been caused by any one of a dozen things, the way the world was now, but Van had no doubt what had lit a fire under the boy. It wasn't an intuition, it was a rock-solid certainty.
Kid! She shouted. Kid, where are they?
Kent Daly paid her no mind, only pedaled faster. He was thinking about the old homeless woman they had been goofing with. They never should have done it. This was God paying them back, paying him back. He pedaled faster still. 8. Although Maynard Griner had left the halls of Academe while still in the 8th grade, and those halls had been delighted to see him go, he was good with machinery.
When his younger brother passed him the bazooka and one of the shells, May handled them as if he had been doing so all his life. He examined the shell's high explosive tip, the wire that ran down the side of the thing, and the fins at the base. He grunted, nodded, and aligned the shell's fins with the grooves inside the tube. It slid in easy-peasy. He pointed to a lever above the trigger and below the black plastic inventory tag.
"Pull that back. Should lock her in."
Lo did and heard a click.
"Is that it, May?"
"Should be, as long as Fritz put in a fresh battery. I believe it's electric charge that fires the rocket."
"If he didn't, I'll go on back there and ram-guzzle him," Lo said.
His eyes were sparkling as he faced Drew T. Barry's plate glass window and rested the bazooka on his shoulder in the best war movie style.
"Stand clear, brother."
The battery in the trigger housing turned out to be just fine. There was a hollow whoosh. Exhaust shot from the tube. The display window blew out into the street, and before either man had time to draw a breath, the front of the sheriff's station exploded. Chunks of sand-colored brick and shards of glass rained down on the street.
"Hoo-wee!"
May slapped his brother on the back.
"Did you see that, brother?"
"I did," Lo replied.
An alarm was braying somewhere deep inside the wounded station. Men were running to look. The front of the building was now a gaping mouth filled with broken teeth. They could see flames inside and paperwork fluttering around like singed birds.
"Reload me."
May aligned the fins of a second shell and latched it tight.
"All set."
May was hopping with excitement. This was more fun than the time they'd thrown a package of dynamite into the trout tank up at Tupelo Crossing.
"Fire in the hole,"
Lo shouted and pulled the bazooka's trigger. The shell flew across the street on a trail of smoke. The men who had come out to gawk saw it and either turned tail or hit the deck. The second explosion gutted the center of the building. Linnea's cocoon had survived the first blast, but not this second one. Moths flew up from where she had been and caught fire.
"Let May have a turn."
May held out his hands for the bazooka.
"No, we need to get out of here," Lo said. "But you'll get your chance, brother. That I promise."
"When? Where?"
"Up to the prison."
9. Van Lampley stood by her ATV, stunned. She had seen the first contrail cross Main Street and knew what it meant even before the blast. Those son-of-a-bitch and Griner brothers had gotten an RPG launcher or something like it from Fritz Mieschaum. As the smoke from the second blast began to clear, she could see flames licking out from holes that had been windows. One of the triple doors was lying in the street, twisted into a corkscrew of chromed steel. The others were nowhere to be seen. Woe to anyone who was in there, she thought. Red Platt, one of the salesmen at Dueling Kia, came swaying and staggering toward her. Blood was sheeting down the right side of his face, and his lower lip no longer looked completely attached, although with all the blood it was hard to tell.
"What was that?"
Red shouted in a cracked voice. Shards of glass glittered in his thinning hair.
"What the fuck was that?"
"The work of two swinging dicks who need a broom handle stuck in their spokes before they hurt anyone else," Van said. "You ought to get patched up, Red." She walked toward the shell station, feeling like herself for the first time in days. She knew it wouldn't last, but while it did, she intended to ride the adrenaline. The gas station was open, but unattended. Van found a 10-gallon can in the garage bay, filled it at one of the pumps, and left a 20 on the counter beside the cash register. The world might be ending, but she had been raised to pay her bills. She toted the can back to her ATV, filled the tank, and headed out of town in the direction the Griner brothers had gone. 10. Kent Daly was having a very bad night, and it wasn't even 8 o'clock. He had no more than turned off Route 31 and accelerated toward the buses blocking West Lavin Road when he was clotheslined off his bike and driven to the ground. His head hit the asphalt and bright lights flashed in front of his eyes. When they cleared, he saw the muzzle of a rifle 3 inches from his face.
"Shit fire!"
exclaimed Reed Barrows, the deputy who had taken Kent down. Reed had been placed at the southwest point of Terry's compass rose. He put his gun down and hauled Kent up by the front of his shirt.
"I know you. You're the kid who was putting firecrackers in mailboxes last year."
Men were running toward them from the new and improved roadblock, Frank Geary in the lead. Terry Coombs brought up the rear, weaving slightly. They knew what had happened in town. There had already been a dozen calls on a dozen cell phones, and they could easily see the fire burning in the middle of dueling from this high vantage point. Most of them wanted to go tear-assing back, but Terry, fearing it was a diversion to get the woman out, had ordered them to hold their positions.
"What are you doing out here, Daly?" Reed asked. "You could have gotten yourself shot."
"I've got a message," Kent said, rubbing the back of his head. It wasn't bleeding, but a large knot was forming there. "It's for Terry or Frank, or both of them."
"What the fuck's going on?"
Don Peters asked. He had donned a football helmet at some point. His close-set eyes, deep in the shadow of the forehead shield, looked like those of a small and hungry bird.
"Who's this?"
Frank pushed Don aside and dropped to one knee beside the kid.
"I'm Frank," he said. "What's the message?"
Terry also took a knee. His breath was redolent of booze.
"Come on, son. Take a deep breath. Deep breath. And pull yourself together."
Kent groped among his scattered thoughts.
"That woman in the prison there, the special one, she's got friends in town. Lots of them. Two of them grabbed me. They said to tell you to stop what you're doing and go away, or the sheriff's office will only be the first thing to go."
Frank's lips stretched in a smile that came nowhere near his eyes. He turned to Terry.
"So what do you think, Sheriff? Are we going to be good boys and go away?"
Little Lowe was no Mensa candidate himself, but he possessed a degree of cunning that had kept the Griner operation afloat for almost 6 years before he and his brother had finally been brought down. Lowe blamed his generous nature. They had let the McDavid cunt, who was hardly a 10, hang around, and she had repaid them by becoming a snitch. He had an instinctive grasp of human psychology in general, and male psychology in particular. When you told men they oughtn't to do a thing, that was what they did. Terry didn't hesitate.
"Not going away. Going in at sunrise. Let them blow up the whole goddamn town."
The men who had gathered around raised a cheer so hoarse and so savage that Kent Daly flinched. What he wanted more than anything was to take his sore head home, lock all the doors, and go to sleep. 11. So far, the adrenaline was holding out. Van hammered on Fritz Mischaum's door hard enough to rattle it in its frame. A long-fingered hand that looked as if it had too many knuckles pulled aside a filthy curtain. A stubble-spackled face peered out. A moment later, the door opened. Fritz opened his mouth, but Van seized him and began to shake him like a terrier with a rat before he could utter a word.
"What did you sell them, you scrawny little shitepoke? Was it a rocket launcher? It was, wasn't it? How much did those bastards pay you so they could blow a hole in the middle of downtown?"
By then they were inside, Van roughly steering Fritz across his cluttered living room. He beat feebly at one of her shoulders with his left hand. The other arm was bound in a makeshift sling that looked as if it had been made from a bedsheet.
"Quit it!" Fritz shouted. "Quit it, woman! I already had my damn arm dislocated by them two cretins!"
Van shoved him down in a filthy armchair with a stack of old skin magazines beside it.
"Talk." "It wasn't a rocket launcher. It was a vintage Russian bazooka. Could have sold it for $6,000-$7,000 at one of those parking lot gun sales up in Wheeling, and those two country fried fuckers stole it."
"Well, of course you would say that, wouldn't you?"
Van was panting.
"It's the truth."
Fritz looked at her more closely, his eyes sliding from her round face to her big breasts to her wide hips, then back up again.
You're the first woman I've seen in 2 days. How long you been awake?
Since last Thursday morning.
Holy moly, that must be a record.
Not even close. Van